voice tell him, "I am absolutely certain we can work this out to your complete satisfaction. Then go immediately into your variation of my car stop steps. My name is Blank, and my job here is to get to the bottom of just these types of matters. Let me tell you what information will be most helpful in being sure this is taken care of. Once everything has been clarified, you can present options. Based on what you've told me, here is what I am prepared to do. By policy, I can refund your money, replace the item, or give you the appropriate credit in your account. Which would be best for you?" The appropriate close will tell you whether the person has been completely satisfied. Will that take care of it? Is there anything else we can do for you? Worth memorizing. Jot my rhetorical approach on a card and carry it with you until you have memorized it. PAVPO, perspective, audience, voice, purpose, and organization. Chapter 18. How to Diagnose a Verbal Encounter. You'll find I'm big on acronyms, anything that will help me remember what to do and when and how to do it. Another one that can help you diagnose a verbal encounter and thus skillfully deal with people under pressure is PACE. Problem, situation you're in, audience, to whom you are speaking, constraints, obstacles to effective communication, and ethical presence, your professional face. Problem. How do you size up what's facing you? I answered a call one night that a man was holding his son hostage with a knife. His apartment was surrounded by the SWAT team, and the man was in a corner about 20 feet from the door, holding a knife to the throat of his son, who appeared to be about 6 or 7 years old. As I approached the door, which was partially barricaded, the man shouted, "Stay where you are, pig! I'll kill you and the boy!" I stopped and held up my hands. "Whoa," I said. "I'm not coming any closer." "What's the matter, sir?" He said, "I have to kill my boy." I said, "What do you mean you have to kill your boy? You don't have to kill him. There are many things you can do besides kill him, aren't there?" "No, I've got to kill my boy." "Well, tell me about it." He said, "My boy's possessed of the devil. My ex-wife was a she-devil, and she poisoned his soul, poisoned his blood, and I've got to bloodlet him. I've got to cleanse him, cut his throat and cleanse him, or the devil will take him forever." Here I am, a professional at the door, thinking, this guy's crazy. Clearly, I had a problem, and it wasn't hard to define. The crazy man was the problem, and my job was to take the knife away, save the boy's life, and arrest the man. The thing is, there are always two kinds of problems in any difficult encounter. Your problem, as you define it as a professional, and the problem from the other person's point of view. If I had stopped at my problem and begun my discourse there, I'd have yet a third problem, bigger than either of the two I had already. I saw the man as the problem, he saw the boy as the problem. If I had approached him as if he were the problem, he would have merely disagreed and resisted, and at worst killed the boy, and maybe some of us cops in the process. This is the epitome of what I call the rhetorical problem, how the other person sees it. And he will never see it the way you do, especially if he's crazy, or under any other influence or delusion. I've learned the hard way that the only way to succeed in these situations is to define the problem from the other person's point of view first. Frankly, the first thing I said to the man was wholly ineffective. I said, "But sir, wait a minute. The blood that runs in the boy's veins runs in yours. If you cut his throat, that's your identity going into the floorboards as well as his. Think about it." He wasn't buying. He screamed, "No, I said the blood was poisoned. It's poisoned." So I came at him a different way, with a new kind of appeal. "But wait a minute. Why would you give your ex-wife power? She'd love to see you kill the thing you love the most in order to save it. That only makes her look good and feel good. But it takes from you the very thing you love." I thought that was a pretty powerful argument, because I was looking at it from only my point of view. I certainly wouldn't kill someone I loved in order to save him. But my approach angered the man. He zoomed from a 7 to a 9 on the emotional scale of 1 to 10. "Good work, Thompson." He jiggled the knife at his son's throat and said, "She's a dead woman anyway. I'm going to kill her later." Finally, I came to my senses. and began to try to work with instead of against the man. I said, "Whoa, wait a minute. What if I told you, sir, that I know a priest who, by just passing his hands over your boy, can get the evil spirits out? That way, you keep the thing you love the most, and your ex-wife loses." He looked at me for a minute, clearly stunned. "Do you really know somebody like that?" And I said, "You bet I do. He owes me some favors. Listen, let me talk to him and see if we can get him here." "But I can't trust you. You're a cop." I candidly didn't know what to do with that at the moment, so I deflected it with a strip phrase. "Sir, I appreciate that, but trust is not an issue at this point." Imagine the absurdity of that, but it worked. "I can't help you. I stand before you unarmed for good reason. Only the priest can help you." To make a long story short, he put the knife down. If I had dwelt on my perspective, that the man was the problem, even though I was right, I couldn't have helped. I had to see the problem as he did, so I could seem to be working with him to get it solved. That also saved the boy's life, so mission accomplished. While it may have seemed absurd for me to buy into his craziness of seeing the boy as the problem, I did it for the greater benefit. Audience. The question in this context is how your audience differs from you. What made that man different from me? How did he see the event differently? What were his values and beliefs? Of course he was crazy, but that didn't help me analyze the situation. The big difference between us was his belief system. He was highly superstitious. I have my superstitions, and with my history of an Indian influencing my childhood, attending a Quaker high school, and assimilating Eastern influences through the martial arts, I have my own views of spirituality. But superstitious, I'm not. I had to keep that in mind when I negotiated with the man. Constraints. Just about anything can be considered a constraint, but in this case, clearly this man's rage, his brain damage, his influence, his belief systems, all were obstacles. There is only one of three things you can do with a restraint. Step around it, ignore it, or use it. I ignored his hatred and distrust of cops. I let his threat to kill me fly by. Remember, man throws spear at head, move head. I stepped around his mistrust with a strip phrase and got to the heart of the matter. Had he been thinking rationally, he would have known that trust was the whole point here. Was I going to help him or thwart him? You know what my goal was. No, the major constraint was his superstition, and when I finally tapped into that, I had found the answer. I appealed to and used the very thing that had made him difficult to talk to in the first place. In other words, if he believed bloodletting would take care of poisoned blood, he'd certainly go for a religious ceremony that would do the same without hurting his son. Knowing what makes your audience different from you allows you to adapt, show empathy, and work with them. If they're in left field, you've got to use left field language. Ethical presence. Notice that throughout my dealings with the man, I tried to exude ethical presence, a concern. I was saying, in effect, "I'm working with you, sir. Listen to me." If I couldn't convince him of that, I was going to fail for sure. That is why it is so important to keep your professional face in front. Show concern at all times. Again, sometimes you're bluffing, and frankly, I don't apologize for misleading an easily misled crazy person who is a threat to someone else's life. If you consider yourself a scrupulously honest person and think I'm advocating situational ethics here, you're right. But ask yourself, if a crazed man with a butcher knife broke into your house and asked you where your baby was, would you feel obligated to tell the truth? I hope not. The fact was, I didn't know a priest. We did get the man the psychiatric help he needed, but I had said whatever I needed to get that boy out of that traumatic situation. In spite of that, remember that in its everyday application, verbal judo is not about conning people. Con men use words to raise your expectations, and then they use those expectations to cheat you for their own profit. The goal of verbal judo, on the other hand, is to benefit both parties in a confrontation. Use pace with your spouse and with your children. Use it in the workplace. The next time you have an argument, before you start snapping back and using your words to address your own feelings, Why not stop and analyze? What is the problem? How does my opponent see it? How is my opponent different from me? What constraints make it so difficult to deal with him today? And remember to keep a concerned and caring face. That in itself is often enough to deflect abuse. Chapter 19. The Language of Reassurance. Fancy and complicated research goes into the subject of communication all the time, and many experts consider it a complex topic. As the founder of verbal judo, I am amazed at the simplicity of communication. Even I have had to codify and systematize the discipline, but I found that if you learn the underlying principles, you don't need to remember every detail of the training. Consider the language of calming people down, what I call the language of reassurance. There may be 100 different ways to calm people, but I believe there's only one principle that underlies all those techniques. It consists of 3 words. Empathy absorbs tension. And one of them, as you will see, is one of my favorite hobby horses. If you can project understanding, empathy, you will absorb like a sponge the tension of your child, your spouse, or anyone else you're dealing with. When I say there are hundreds of techniques to do this, I'm referring to all those little things people do that prove that it works. In other words, no matter what approach you choose, if the result somehow shows empathy, tension will be absorbed and you have begun to succeed in verbal judo. Can't remember one of my acronyms? Do something to empathize. Forget which step comes next in a list of suggestions. Empathize, empathize, empathize. Regardless what you do, if you don't absorb tension, you will fail. Use this book as a manual, a reminder, a source. But get the principles clearly in your mind so that when you're in the heat of battle, you're doing the right thing even if you're not going about it the precise way I or one of my instructors would. You'd think I would have my whole course memorized as many times as I've taught it. And if I were forced at gunpoint to regurgitate it, I probably could. But even I fall back on the basic principles sometimes, when there's simply no opportunity to carefully weigh options and remember steps. The cap and the card. I was on the street for a ride along in California one night when Ron, the police officer I was with, arrested a subject on a minor felony warrant. The perpetrator was about 16 years old. At about 3 a.m., the boy's mother was standing on her porch shouting obscenities. The officer, one of the most skillful I've ever seen, put the kid in the car, turned to me in the front seat, and said, "I'll be with you in a moment, George." Frankly, I wished he'd jumped into the patrol car and we were gone because the woman's yelling had attracted more than a dozen angry neighbors. Their sleep had been interrupted by these cops, who had, in their minds, hassled some innocent kid they'd seen grow up on that street. They came out sniffing the air like Doberman pinschers. It was as if they were asking themselves, "Is there something here for me? Anything I need to stick my nose into? What's going on here?" I was tense because those people were surrounding the car. They weren't saying anything, but it was an uneasy, potentially explosive situation. Suddenly Ron walked up to the woman, took off his hat, put it under his arm as if he had all night, reached into his pocket for a business card, and said, "Ma'am, listen to me. My name is Officer Ron Blank, and I'm with the Blank Police Department. I'm arresting your boy because I have to. I have a warrant. If I don't arrest him, they arrest me. But it's a minor warrant, ma'am. I don't blame you for being upset, because I have a son about your boy's age, and I'd be upset too. But he'll be out in the morning. Listen, don't stand out here tonight. Get some rest. Come on down to the police department in the morning. Bring your friends. Bring a lawyer if you want. Your son will have been processed by then, and you'll be able to talk to him. And look, if anyone gives you any trouble down there, you call my number and I'll take care of it. You don't deserve any more problems. You have a good night now." He turned and walked away, putting his hat back on, and we drove off while the woman was thanking him. Her son was cuffed in the back of that car, and she was grateful. I was astounded. That woman was on the porch, hands on her hips, mouth open, virtually speechless. No more virulence, no more obscenities. She was just staring as we pulled away. The people who had surrounded the car were quiet, everybody watching. I could have applauded. Imagine how much safer Ron would be if he had to go back into that neighborhood the next night to make an arrest. Everything Ron did showed respect and dignity. Later I asked him about the hat and the card business. He said, "That's an old trick, George. I sometimes forget to show proper verbal respect because I'm busy or we're rushed, so I wear the hat. You take the hat off, it shows people respect. The more difficult the neighborhood, the more important respect is." I nodded. "What about that card?" He said, "That card's interesting, isn't it? Number one, when I handed her the card, that shows I'm a professional. Shows I'm not afraid about what I'm doing. Second, even though I invited her to call me with any complaints, you know she probably won't. But still, I might hear from her. I've made more good felony arrests over the years with those cards, because I've left them all over the community. That woman is apt to call me a year from now and say, 'Officer Ron, you remember me? You arrested my boy last October on that minor felony warrant. Why aren't you out here cracking down on these people selling drugs right out the back door of number 112 every day between 4 and 5 in the morning?' Well, I thank her, and I get on with it. And usually these people are right. Their leads are good. The cards have helped me cultivate a beat." I noticed he said, "cultivate a beat," not "run a beat." And I thought how lucky that city was to have a guy like Ron on the streets. You may not wear a hat or even carry business cards. That's why the principle is more important than the specific technique. How many ways are there to show empathy and concern and to absorb tension? Calm down and speak English. Now, a surefire way to escalate tension is to break a cardinal rule of calming someone by shouting "calm down" and insult him in the process. I inherited a problem that began that way one night. I drove into the police station to begin my shift when I came upon an older officer trying to deal with a young Japanese girl who was hysterical. She was crying and shouting at him in unintelligible half-pigeon English and half-Japanese. He was upset and shouting right back at her, "Calm down and speak English. How can I help you if I can't understand you? What's the matter with you?" As soon as he saw me, he saw his chance to finish his shift and get home. "You there," he said. "You come and deal with her. I haven't got any idea what she's saying, and I'm out of here." Then he was gone, and she was in my face. Almost instinctively, because there certainly was no book on this subject back then, I reached into my pocket and came out with my black book and pen and handed them to her. "Here, ma'am," I said quietly. "Write. Write down problem." As she grabbed the book and the pen, I noticed three things. Number one, she had stopped yelling. You can't yell and write at the same time. Number two, what she had in her hands was tangible evidence that someone had time for her, cared about her, wanted to help her, and would work on her problem, whatever it was. Number three, I realized that it didn't make much difference what she wrote. I doubted I would be able to read a thing she put on that page. My guess and my hope was that if I could get her busy helping me get the message, it would calm her enough that I could make some sense of it. When she handed the book back to me, I played my Lieutenant Columbo role. I squinted at it, held it up to the light, looked at her, nodded, looked back at it, and basically counted to 10. My looking interested in what she had written seemed to calm her. When I finally tucked the book away, I said in as fatherly a tone as possible, "What's the matter?" By now, she had calmed down enough to get three words out I could understand. "Boyfriend in there," she said, pointing at our jail. I motioned to her and said, "Come, come. Come with me." I took her inside, found out that her boyfriend had just been released, and was able to tell her, "Not here. Not here. Go home." She was so grateful, thanking me over and over. I didn't know it at the time, but that was real service. I had used a technique, making use of tactile objects to indicate concern. My empathy had absorbed the tension. How many different techniques are there, like the book and the pen, or the hat and the card? People to whom English is a second or third language will resort to their own tongue when they get upset. Their communication skills abandon them, and it's up to you and me to find creative ways to calm them. I never knew such things when I was teaching English, because I didn't have to. On the street, I had to come up with 100 such techniques. Principally, stick to the principles. When I studied physical judo and jiu-jitsu, I discovered that the fighting arts, which are complicated in terms of their numerous techniques, are also very simple in terms of bottom-line principles. For example, one of the major principles in empty hand control is, go to a weak area when grabbed. In other words, if someone grabs your wrist, turn it back toward his thumb, the weakest area. You can slip away easily. That's much like the principle I'm talking about. There may be 100 ways to calm people, but the bottom line is, empathy absorbs tension. If you keep that in your mind when you deal with your children, your spouse, or an angry customer, you'll be able to use my techniques with ease and skill. You don't need to remember my specific suggestions, because whatever you do to show empathy and absorb tension will be right. For instance, a woman friend of mine, picnicking with her family in a forest preserve, came upon a scene where a toddler had wandered off. He was not yet 2 years old. His parents each thought the other was watching him, and he disappeared. The rangers had been notified, and they immediately went to the pool and to a stream to be sure he would not drown. Other volunteers began combing the woods. But the young mother, panicky, turned her anger on her husband, who was shaken. "How could you let him out of your sight?" she demanded. "He's a baby!" "You think I did it on purpose? I thought he was with you." The temptation might have been to shush these two, to tell them, "Knock it off. You're not helping find your child by bitching at each other." But my friend was wise. She separated them and calmed the mother. A total stranger, she approached the wife and embraced her. She didn't know specific steps, but she instinctively knew the principle that empathy absorbs tension. She said, "Whenever one of my babies wandered off, I froze. Immediate empathy and a calming influence, i.e., this is a common occurrence. The only thing I could do was to turn my full attention to finding her, and I didn't give up until I did. And let me tell you something, I always found her." Reassurance. The mother immediately came to her senses and joined a search party. The child was found shortly, having strayed to another picnic where a clown was entertaining. No one noticed him there until the searchers came looking. My point is that following the exact steps and stages is less consequential than knowing the principles. Chapter 20. How to Fight Fair. A life of peace and harmony is a worthy goal, and there are still some people who think it's possible to live that way 100% of the time. This probably won't be big news to you, but to them I say, welcome to the real world. A good, clean fight can change a negative situation to a positive one and release tension. Sometimes you just have to get into it with somebody to clear the air, don't you? One or the other of you is itching for a fight. I'm speaking, of course, of a verbal, not physical tussle here, and the only solution is to have at it. Keeping feelings bottled up results in frustrations being expressed in weird and inappropriate ways. Have you ever wondered why you or your spouse seem bitchy and mean-spirited about things that seem to have nothing to do with anything? That's a description of someone who needs to deal with the issues at hand. A clean, effective verbal confrontation is designed to strengthen rather than damage a relationship. I want to teach you to express hostile feelings without humiliating or destroying others in the process. 4 steps to a good domestic dispute. What's the goal of a fight at home? Most people think it's to win, but if you think that, you're brain damaged. How's that for a nice verbal judo samurai way of breaking it to you? But seriously, the goal is not to win, because my experience is that you cannot win a domestic dispute. Oh, you may win temporarily, but you'll find yourself sleeping in the pickup truck or apologizing the next day. No, think about it. Fighting is not bad, if you keep in mind that the goal is to strengthen the relationship, to draw yourselves closer by having the freedom to argue without destroying each other. The prototype I recommend to help you generate closure and keep the higher goal in mind, long-term harmony, does not lend itself to an acronym. It simply goes like this. 1. Paraphrase. 2. Paraphrase again. 3. Refocus the other's attention. 4. Say what you want to say. Let's say a man marries for a second time, and he inherits 4 children from his wife's first marriage. They've now been married about 2 months, so he still feels in a bit of a honeymoon glow, thinking things are moving along swimmingly, despite tripping over the offspring now and then. One day he arrives at home after a difficult day at work, and his wife hits him with, "You know, I'm getting sick of you. Every time you come home and sit down to dinner, you do everything you can to purposely undermine me with my children. Remember, they are my children and not yours, and I'm fed up with your trying to make me look bad in front of them." Now notice that she broke a cardinal rule of verbal judo, using absolute phrases like "every time" and "purposely," so his first inclination might be to strike back with verbal karate. If he does, they've got a real Donnybrook on their hands. He could say, "I do not. I didn't do that last night." Or, "How can you say I've done that on purpose? I didn't even know I had ever done that." Or, "Why didn't you tell me? Am I supposed to read your mind?" The guy is probably reeling for the reason most of us would reel in the same situation. We aren't aware we've offended or have even been an irritation to anyone. We go merrily about our business, thinking everyone is thrilled to be in our presence, only to be blindsided by what we think are spurious, mean-spirited charges. Here's what I would recommend to the husband who's just been brought back to reality by his new and frustrated wife. 1. Paraphrase. First, employing a trusty sort of insertion like "whoa," follow with "wait a minute, darling," totally without sarcasm, you're reaffirming your affection even in the heat of battle, subliminally establishing that your goal is to make things right and maintain the relationship. "Let me be sure I hear what you're saying." Here comes the paraphrase. "You're angry at me because you think I come home every night and do everything I can to purposely undermine you in front of the children. Is that the way you feel?" Notice how disinterested is the tone. There's no condemnation or put down at the end of that, implied or otherwise. If I'm right, what the husband will hear next will be some sort of a modification, a softening of the original charge, because people rarely mean exactly what they say when they're angry. One of the only reasons this would not be forthcoming would be if the husband had implied in his paraphrase any sarcasm or undue emphasis on words like "you think." If those are hit too hard, the wife may react in anger. "I don't think, I know." On the other hand, the husband has to phrase it that way so he's not admitting that whatever he did on purpose. If all goes well, the wife will likely say something like, "Well, I don't know if you do it every night, but you have sure done it the last 3 nights." Now it's time for the next step. 2. Paraphrase again. "Okay, darling, you're angry at me because for the last 3 nights I have come home and purposely tried to undermine you in front of your children." Now he's apt to hear yet another slight modification. "Well, I don't know if you purposely meant to do it, but you sure got the job done." With just a little careful, loving counteraction, the husband has already seen his disgruntled wife lower her charge from "you always purposely do this" to "at least you did it the last 3 nights, and I'm not saying it was on purpose." That's a significant modification. She has been cooled 100 degrees. So now it's time for the next step. 3. Refocus the other's attention. Still in a conciliatory tone, the husband should now say something like, "Let me ask you something. What specifically did I do the last 3 nights that led you to believe I was trying to undermine you?" After a pause while she thinks about it, he will likely be hit with some serious data. "Well, you did A, B, and C. That's what you did." Now he has something concrete to work with. 4. Say what you want to say. Now is the most crucial time in the argument. The husband needs to state his case, all the while convincing his wife that he has the relationship at heart. In himself, he might want only to defend himself, to react in anger for being what he feels is falsely accused. But he's a verbal judo expert. He knows that if she perceives something, it's true in her mind, and he has to deal with it, even if she's wrong. This is another of those times to bury the ego, take a lump or two, and concentrate on persuading your opponent that you're as interested in preserving the relationship as she is. So he says, "Let me ask you something, hon. Could we talk about the difference between what I do and what I intend to do? I didn't marry you 2 months ago to destroy the relationship, but I'm doing something wrong. Can we talk about it?" Now, unless the wife is impossible, he's going to get some cooperation. She wanted to be heard, and clearly he has heard her. Isn't that what most people want when they yell and scream? His voice should sound as though he cares. He should be using everything he knows about pace and pitch and modulation and tone. The bottom line message that will turn this fight into making up comes when he tells her, in one form or another, I love you. I don't want to make you mad. I certainly don't want to undermine you in front of your children or even appear that I am. I'm sorry. Forgive me and tell me how I can change so you know I'm serious about this. Whenever there is a domestic conflict, one of the parties is going to be more difficult than the other, more under the influence than the other, more unreasonable just then. Spouses will often change roles depending on their distractions and how their day has gone. One day he's the angry bear and she's trying to be rational and keep the peace. The next day it's the other way around. To me, one of the great signs of true love is the ability to take over and cover for the other when he or she is having a bad day. The hope is that he or she will do the same for you when you need it. I've been through enough broken relationships to know I learned this stuff the hard way. Simple and logical as it is, no one ever said, George, stay calm, do not express your ego, paraphrase, try to get at what your wife feels and means, see if you've got it right before you react. It was only when I began to transfer verbal judo tactics and skills from the street to the home that I realized these principles cross all lines and barriers. You don't have to be a cop facing down a junkie in an alley to use verbal judo to your benefit. You can use it at home. If you have burned bridges, alienated people, and lost marriages, families, and credibility, maybe now is the time to start using these techniques to preserve some relationships. Does my four-step model always work? Will it guarantee a lifetime marriage? I can't say that. But I believe it will work most of the time. The key lies within the depth of your sincerity, which is hard to combat. If you are committed to the relationship to the point where you are willing to bury your ego and get at what's really bothering your spouse, trust me, this will work. Chapter 21. Take the Giant Leaps. I have identified 5 basic tools to generate voluntary compliance, and, you guessed it, they fit into an acronym, LEAPS. Listen, empathize, ask, paraphrase, summarize. Some of these I have already dealt with in detail, and of course all of them have been mentioned in one or another related context. But in this chapter, I want to review the importance of each of these tools. Each is distinct. Anytime you communicate with anyone, you're using one or more of these, not necessarily in any particular order. So, though I have fit them into the acronym for easier remembering, I don't want you to think of them as sequential. Rather, think of them as ongoing, changing skills you must use to be effective with people, especially those under pressure. Let's take them one at a time. Listen. When you listen, you've got to look like you're listening. Project a face that makes it obvious. Frankly, if I had to choose between listening carefully and appearing to listen carefully, I'd opt for the latter. People often say things that are not worth hearing. You've heard them all before. A person may not even make sense. But the moment your eyes glaze over as if you're uninterested or don't care, conflict can erupt. So it's even more important to look interested than to be interested. In Chapter 14, I dealt with the 4 levels of listening: being open, literally hearing, interpreting, and acting. Underscore these by projecting a listening face. Empathize. Let me clarify that while empathizing essentially means standing in the shoes of another or seeing through the eyes of another, I'm not suggesting you have to agree with that person. Obviously, I don't agree with the superstitious man who held his own son hostage and thought he had to bloodlet him. But everyone is entitled to a point of view, right or wrong, just or unjust. Don't agree. Just try to understand where the person is coming from. Too many people confuse empathy with sympathy. You don't have to sympathize with or approve of another's actions or words. Just empathize and see how powerful it makes you. Don't do it to be nice. Do it because it's the only way to hit upon a proper appeal. There are four types of appeals you can make to people to try to get them to voluntarily comply with your wishes: the ethical, the reasonable, the personal, and the practical. Empathizing will help determine which of these might be most effective initially. If you agree that as a contact professional, your work entails bending the will of others at times, you will also agree that the way in which you appeal to a person is key. Your reputation and power depends on how well you can skillfully manage other people's behavior. The most powerful professional presence you can project is with a straight ethical appeal. The word ethical comes from the Greek ethos, meaning self. In this case, it's your persona, your professional service face. Because of your role and carriage and bearing, this approach is seen and felt by others and forcefully establishes your credibility. Think of the ethical approach as your professional face as you present it and as it impacts upon another person. The ethical appeal is step one in the five-step hard style. See chapter 12. Ask. The way you ask somebody to do something, particularly tonal, establishes whether you want to help or are just there to cause a problem. If I asked a man, "Would you please step out of the vehicle?" I might get more cooperation than by barking at him to get out. My voice would indicate professionalism right from the start. If people believe in you, in your service, in your desire to help, often that in itself is enough to generate voluntary compliance. The moment the people you're dealing with begin to think you don't like them, or that you're irritated, or you don't like what you're doing, you lose the ethical appeal. Then you have to solicit reason by moving to what I call the reasonable appeal. Because people are not always logical, especially when under duress, I have a basic rule with this one. Never use it when people are upset. First calm them, then try logic. Remember, under pressure, common sense is a most highly uncommon commodity. When you're setting context in step two of the five-step hard style, you're using the reasonable appeal. You're saying, "This is policy. This is procedure. These are the grounds I have to stand on. These are my constraints." This approach alone will calm many people. With truly difficult people, the third appeal, personal appeal, tends to be most powerful. Why? Because with this appeal, you're putting what you want them to do in terms of what they have to gain or lose. Are most people selfish? You bet they are. So hook into their attention span. Very few people will go against their own interests, including me. This appeal has been used effectively on me numerous times, especially when I've been upset at people in positions of authority. When they show me how what they're doing will ultimately benefit me, they win me over. Very powerful. The fourth appeal is a strange one I call the practical appeal. This involves the use of offbeat strategies like humor, redirection, and refocusing that will gain voluntary compliance, provided they do not compromise your safety or integrity or violate your organization's policies. When faced with resistance, try varying your appeal, but always display empathy. Ask. There is a process of asking questions that can make you more skillful. I never had much training in asking questions, and I doubt you have either. Most people have no idea that there are actually at least five different types of questions. Fact-finding. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. Fact-finding questions ask for specific data. Most people are naturally pretty good at these because they often concern practical matters and require only clear-cut answers. But they don't often have the best effect on people. General. By definition, general questions are often open-ended. For example, "What really happened here today?" In reply, a person can say anything he wants. This allows him to choose the direction of his answer and makes him feel good. Opinion seeking. Like general questions, opinion seeking questions ask for an opinion and allow latitude. You might ask, "Is there some way we can solve this problem? What's your view of how we ought to go about this?" This approach is very powerful because most everyone likes to voice his opinion. Even if you're not terribly interested in the answer, ask anyway, and remember to look interested and make it obvious that you're listening. You may be surprised. The person might even have something profitable to say. Direct. Direct questions are basically your yes or no questions. Did you dump the garbage on this man's lawn? Did you go to so-and-so's house? Did you spend the money? Though the questions may not in themselves be antagonistic, too many direct questions in a row can make people feel machine-gunned. I had a problem with this when I was a new cop, because I was more interested in getting information from my reports than I was in being empathetic with those involved. Leading. Leading questions almost always anger people because essentially they put words into their mouths. Isn't it true that you need to be as strategic as possible in your questioning, and I recommend two tactics. First, try setting context for people before launching into your questions. I call it forecasting. In other words, simply explain the direction and purpose of your questioning. Don't just start firing questions. Say, "Friend, I have 6 or 7 questions here, mostly concerning the cause of your trouble. I wonder if you'd be willing to work with me and try to answer them." If people don't know how many questions you have, what they're about, and that you're going to stop, they become impatient and tenser as you go on. It's always appropriate to tell people what you're about. It calms them and makes them more cooperative, and that means the nature of the information you get will be far better. Second, vary your questions. This also lessens resistance and calms an audience. Start with a series of general questions to loosen people up, then ask some opinion-seeking questions. Gradually, naturally, move to the more direct and fact-finding questions. Resort to leading questions only when necessary. Of my 5 types of questions, the general and the opinion-seeking do more to generate voluntary compliance than the other 3 put together. They make you appear empathic, caring, open, and unbiased, whether or not you really are. Direct and leading questions anger people much of the time. The moment you see in the eyes of someone that he is becoming tense, you know he's probably feeling attacked. That's the time to move right back to a general question. The ability to fasten down on somebody and to lighten up when necessary by varying your questions is one of the great arts of interrogation. It's also one of the great arts of talking to your children. You know how far you get with a typical, "How was school?" "Fine." "Well, how was English?" "Fine." Try some others of my 5 types of questions, especially with teenagers, or you may never extract information from them until they're adults. Paraphrase. When someone comes at you with verbal abuse, forget the tone and the emotion. Put the complaint in your own words and play it back for him. Even if you're misunderstood, he can see that you're trying, and he'll want to help you get it straight. See Chapter 10 for my 14 Benefits of Paraphrasing, How to Do It, and several examples. Summarize. Summarizing is a different use of language altogether. By definition, it means condensing, taking all that's been discussed, and putting it into a simple, concise statement. I've long been interested in why some people convey a sense of authority and decisiveness that others lack, and I think one of the clues lies in the way they summarize. Summarizing must have 3 qualities. It must be brief, concise, and above all, inarguable. Let's say as a police officer I stop 5 people fighting in the street, and I listen, empathize, ask, and paraphrase, and finally it comes time for me to make a decision. That decision statement, that declaration of what my choice of action will be, must sound authoritative. People must know how serious I am by the way I go about making my statement. I might say, "Okay, gentlemen, ladies, listen up. You, sir, are free to leave if you leave right now. You two, sir and ma'am, get in your car and head south. And you, sir, you head north. You weren't getting along when I came here, and I want you heading in opposite directions before I leave. And you, you're under arrest. Place your hands behind you. I'm arresting you for such and such under the penal code of the state of..." Now notice I've left no room for argument. Leaving the arrest until after sending the others packing makes clear that I know exactly what I'm talking about and that I will brook no more discussion. How I said it clarifies that discussion is over. Much of summarizing is effected in the voice. You must sound as if you have reached the end and you are now, in your professional capacity, executing the conclusion of the matter. If you have preceded your summary with the first four tools and leaps, your audience will have been made much more receptive. Another benefit of summarizing is that it can reconnect communication when it's been interrupted. Interruptions are one of the phenomena of modern-day communication. While you're conversing, the phone rings, or someone else butts in. To simply turn back to the other person and pick up where you left off without any summarizing bridge is a mistake. By then, the other person's mind has wandered. He's not anchored in the last word you said. Capsulizing where you are at that point will ensure that he once again becomes a good listener. This form of summarizing can take the form of something as simple as, "Now, Jack, we were on the subject of your tardiness, and you were telling me what you were going to do to remedy it. Is that right?" The former head of Los Alamos National Labs once told a colleague and me, "Miscommunication is the sand in the gears of modern technology. We all make mistakes every day, but listening, empathizing, asking, paraphrasing, and summarizing can go a long way to making you more effective." Chapter 22, Applying Leaps to Your World. Most new supervisors think they have to start talking, to dominate, to demonstrate their opinions. But this four-step approach can ensure greater communication effectiveness. 1. Ask. Ask your people what they feel, what they want, or how they think things are going. 2. Listen actively. Repeat steps 1 and 2 as many times as necessary until you feel you have heard everything. 3. Re-evaluate your position. Be sure of where you stand, based on your people's input. Don't change your mind unless that is the right and appropriate course. Don't be afraid to do that. Your people won't see you as weak and manipulable. They'll admire your strength. 4. Deliver the information. Get before your people and tell them how it is going to be. You're in charge. You're the boss, but you don't have to say that. The day you need to remind people who's the boss is the day you should realize you have lost your people. Using the first three steps, you will be much more skillful. You have discovered where the pockets of resistance are. You know what people are thinking, and you can say something like, "Okay, ladies and gentlemen, yesterday I listened to you and I heard you. We agree on a great many issues, and I'm glad you told me about A, B, and C, because I want to address those immediately. About D, E, and F, I don't have enough input or resources to handle them at this time, but I'm asking the following people to get back to me in 3 months to see where we stand on those important issues." You may not have changed a thing, but you know your audience better. You can couch information in their language and appear more competent and in touch. These four steps can help you be a great supervisor if you can avoid the common trap of jumping in and delivering information. The five great tools of communication in leaps can save you untold trouble and create for you credibility which other people can't destroy. You can feel good about what you're doing, avoid conflict, and raise your own estimation of your ability as a professional. Others often base how they feel about you on how you communicate. As you master these skills, people will begin to admire you. Short of building a Charles Atlas body and beating up the bully who used to kick sand in your face at the beach, I can think of no other unequivocal method of achieving admiration than by mastering verbal judo. Don't thank me for shopping here. Maybe you've had an experience similar to mine. You go to a city or a county bureau with a problem. Maybe it's your tax bill or trouble with your water, whatever. But isn't it rare when you get the feeling that the people working there care about serving you? I mean, that's not only their job, their sole reason for being there, but it's also what our tax dollars are supposed to pay for. I know these people are there 8 to 10 hours a day and are listening to similar complaints all the time. But clearly, no one has ever taught them to, 1, keep their egos out of encounters with the public, 2, find the right words for the person they're talking to, and 3, serve people by empathizing with them. In other words, make my experience more pleasant by the way you serve me. We shouldn't be surprised at these bureaucratic lapses, because even in a lot of our retail profit centers, where happy customers are repeat customers, we receive very little good personal service. That's why we tend to teach formulas to people like, "Thank you for shopping here." Sometimes I think I'm going to lose it if I hear that one more time. I know it's not the clerk's fault. he or she has been trained to parrot that phrase, just as waitresses and waiters have been told to say, "Enjoy," when they slide a $30 meal under your nose. Or, "I'm Stacy and I'll be your server. Please! I love the idea of getting the name, but does anyone think it makes me feel special when I get the same patter as everyone else?" I want to hear something unique, or at least fresh, that tells me they're really glad I'm giving them my business, and they'd like to make me so happy that I'll not only come back, but that I will also recommend the place to my friends. The reason we provide formulas for people is that we don't trust them to interact with the public. But certainly you, as I do, recognize a formula when you hear one. I hate them because I know I'm hearing the same thing everyone else has heard that day. I'm no longer an individual. I'm not really being made to feel special. I'm simply getting the canned phrase, the pasted-on smile, and the sing-song farewell that everybody gets. There's nothing more irritating than standing in a long line and hearing every shopper get the standard, "Thank you for shopping here. Have a nice day." Sometimes, as soon as it's my turn, I beat the clerk to the punch. I say, "Whatever you do, don't thank me for shopping here." But, sir, what's wrong?" And I say, "Treat me like an individual. The woman who just bought a bolt of silk and left the store ought to be thanked differently from me. We aren't the same people. She's a little old lady, obviously still industrious and independent. I'm a middle-aged man buying a shotgun and shells. How about a different message for each of us that shows you care? The only thing we customers have in common is that we shop here and make you a profit and pay your salaries." In truth, I want to shout, "What's the matter with you people?" But I know it's not the clerk's fault. Of Silk and Shotguns. Clerks should be taught to be real, to be personal, to look for that unique aspect that gives direct contact to the customer. The little old woman who buys a bolt of silk could be genuinely thanked like this: "Hey, that's a beautiful color choice, ma'am. I hope you enjoy that. What are you making?" And after a brief interchange, then thank the woman for buying it where she bought it, and remind her that she is guaranteed complete satisfaction. "And how about for me, the shotgun buyer? That's one of the top brands we carry, sir. Looks like you're planning some serious hunting. You think I wouldn't love to talk about the trip I've got planned with my buddies? Then tell me you hope I got the service I required at the sporting goods counter, and to feel free to call with any questions. Then thank me for shopping there. By that time, I'll be thanking you and meaning it. But don't just say, 'Thank you for shopping here,' and leave it at that. Treat people like individuals." Chapter 23. Persuasion for Fun and Profit. Don't expect voluntary compliance just because you have a position of authority or responsibility. Generate it. Make it happen. The top communicators, the great cops, leaders, administrators, and managers, know the art of putting things in such a way as to make people more cooperative. The old samurai used to say, "To know and to act are one and the same." To paraphrase Shakespeare, "Suit the word to the deed and the deed to the word." In other words, avoid the disastrous use of language, best summed up in the old Chinese adage, "Control your emotion or it will control you." One of my favorite samurai maxims says, "The angry man will defeat himself in battle as well as in life." We live in the most dangerous of all eras. We are living closer together. There are people under the influence of drugs, liquor, rage, fear, anxiety, ignorance, and stupidity, and violence is commonplace. The key to our success, not to mention our survival, is our ability to stay calm and avoid the anger that makes us ineffective. The anger that made me ineffective as a cop will also make me ineffective as a businessman, an entrepreneur, a husband, a father, a boss, a seminar leader. As I've tried to make clear, I'm one of the original difficult people. My first reaction to stress is to confront. Somebody crosses me, watch out. I'm ready to do battle. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm well trained for physical encounters. I've learned the hard way, though, that winning a battle at the physical level means losing the war in every other respect. I've finally learned, after years of teaching this stuff and seeing it work on the streets, that verbal judo is akin to fishing. I like to fish the high mountain streams and lakes, up to 10,000 feet above sea level. If I'm not skillful up there, I can't hook a thing. And if I do hook a fish, I don't just reel him in as one would a carp. I have to play him in. I play and reel, play and real. When I finally do land one, I get a great feeling of satisfaction and accomplishment. That's also how I feel when I've encountered difficult people, people like me. Developing the Mushin state of mind, that calm center, means regarding difficult people as a challenge rather than as combative adversaries. Doesn't it make sense that we should develop a mindset that allows us to interact with these people skillfully rather than letting them get our goat? The samurai warrior, when surrounded by attackers, went absolutely still inside. He prepared himself by being still so he would not be caught by surprise. He could respond to any attack from any direction, no matter how unexpected. Train yourself to be free of bias, prejudice, and expectation. That's easier said than done, of course, and I'm the first to admit that it isn't something that comes naturally. There is a Chinese word that means both crisis and opportunity. By remembering that, I am now able to like difficult people, or at least to appreciate where they're coming from, and view them as challenges and opportunities rather than obstacles. If a guy gets in my face and says, "I can't do this and I won't do that," I just laugh inside and think, my kind of guy. These are the kinds of people that shaped America. They are people of savvy, of backbone, of principle, of will. Think about it. A whole day of nice people would be boring, but a whole day of difficult people makes us work. They draw on our skill, make us flex our verbal judo skills, and leave us feeling good about our encounters as we succeed. Let me recommend that you begin viewing the difficult people in your orbit as chances to prove your mettle rather than as people to avoid. Difficult customers should be interesting and challenging. Notice that difficult people cross all color boundaries and cultural distinctions. The key to your survival is knowing the kind of person, nice, difficult, or wimpy, you're dealing with, and it should make no difference whether a person is black, white, Hispanic, or Asian. I don't care if a person's a homosexual, a transvestite, or undecided. It's not my business. I care only what he's doing and my ability to redirect him for the better. Avoiding the inner voice. One of the ways to accomplish the task of redirecting behavior, keeping calm in the face of difficult people, and gaining voluntary compliance is to remain sounding professional. That keeps you safe, even when you may no longer care about safety. Inside, your voice may be saying what you really want to say. But one of the laws of effective communication is never utter the inner voice. The inner voice is almost always negative. Control it at all costs, and you'll find yourself way ahead of the game. Personalization. One of the last things our inner voice wants to do when encountering difficult people is to give our name. Yet this gesture of personalizing the dispute, of showing no fear of being identified and being accountable for our decisions and the policies of our governing body, is something that should be applied universally. I don't care whether you're a homemaker, a parent, a banker, an executive, a salesperson, or a service employee. You become more human when I know your name. And don't just offer it mechanically. It shouldn't be, "Hi, I'm Stacy, and I'll be your waitress." Slow it down. Give it some weight, some sincerity. And how about something unique? Set yourself apart. Surely management doesn't expect you to be a robot, just like everyone else on the floor. The formulas they give you are principles, frameworks on which you should hang your own personality. I'd love it if a waitress would say something like, "My name is Stacy Smith, and it's my job to see that you leave here fat and sassy." Or, "It's my job to make sure you get everything you want to eat as quickly as I can get it for you." Later, when the check arrives, if the waitress has built appropriate rapport with me, I wouldn't mind a little humor. It's also my responsibility to see that you don't leave without paying. See what I'm driving at? Something, anything that will humanize the encounter and make people feel as if they've been noticed and that they have matter. Nothing angers me more than when I call an agency and get a receptionist who gives me only a number. "This is 224, sir. How may I help you?" I want to say that person can help me by telling me who I'm dealing with. I want a name. Names have a way of calming people. Names give you a sense that a human being is at the other end of the phone. How hard is it to say, "Good evening, sir. My name's George Thompson. What can I do for you?" Even in a store, it helps if the clerk at the counter says, Hi, I'm Beverly. Let me know if there's any way I can help you, rather than simply, can I help you? Our real purpose. Regardless of our profession or role, we're all in the business of meeting people's needs.